Support for the Legislative Gazette comes from New York State United Teachers, working to support students, educators, and public schools as the center of their communities through the Public Schools Unite Us initiative, and United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org. New York State recently fired some 2,000 correctional officers for not returning to work following a three-week unsanctioned strike. As the Legislative Gazette's Ava Pukach reports, public sector workers in New York are not authorized to go on strike under the Taylor Law.
Governor Kathy Hochul issued an executive order blocking the fired employees from jobs at other state agencies. Art Wheaton is the Director of Labor Studies at Cornell University's School of Industrial and Labor Relations. He described the firings as unfortunate. There's a worker shortage within the Department of Corrections. But he says the firings are not unexpected, as there are penalties from violating the no-strike law.
The state wanted to bend over backwards because they really didn't want to lose them all. So it was risky for the people to go out on strike. If the union endorses it, then the penalties are paid by the union. For the individuals, it's pretty easy to get yourself fired. And in this case, blacklisted, not getting another state job.
Under state law, it's illegal for the employer to negotiate directly with individuals, known as direct dealing. Instead, the union negotiates on their behalf, but
the people out on strike did not necessarily agree to what the mediator, the union, and the Department of Corrections came up as a solution, and they stayed out on strike.
The deal reduces 24-hour mandatory overtime shifts. The state also agreed to a 90-day pause on some provisions of the HALT Act regarding solitary confinement. For the New York Public News Network, I'm Eva Pukach.
Republicans in New York are feeling bullish about their chances of winning statewide office next year. The New York Public News Network's Jimmy Vielkind reports the Nassau County executive is flirting with a run for governor.
For Republicans, the road to the governor's mansion in 2026 starts at a cocktail party in downtown Binghamton. Several hundred people are here for the annual Lincoln Day dinner, a fundraising banquet. Benji Fetterman, who chairs the local GOP committee, says the crowd is excited about President Trump's win and wants to take out Governor Hochul next year.
But we'll welcome any Republican that's motivated to beat Kathy Hochul. That is mission critical for the Republican Party in 2026. We're preparing and ready to strike.
It won't be easy. Republicans have been out of power in state government since 2019, but two potential candidates are hitting the stump. One is Nassau County Executive Bruce Blakeman, who drove up from Long Island to explain how he won in a Democrat-dominated county.
We listened to the people. We got down to basics. We worried about our communities and not about people who've been here for 15 minutes, who came across our border illegally.
Blakeman's speech focused on immigration, keeping transgender girls from playing on girls' sports teams, and his ties to Trump. He's running for re-election to his current job, but he won't rule out a statewide run. Another politician openly pondering a run for governor is Congressmember Mike Lawler from the Hudson Valley. He fended off a Democratic challenger in November, and he's since gone around the state attacking Hochul, including at a recent conference in Albany.
Kathy Hochul is a feckless and failed governor who must be defeated in 2026.
A poll taken this month shows Lawler leading Blakeman among Republicans in a hypothetical gubernatorial primary. The same Siena College survey found 56% of voters would prefer to back someone other than Hochul in 2026. Still, pollster Steven Greenberg says there are 3 million more Democratic voters in New York than Republicans.
Take a step back. New York is a state that has been solidly blue for a long time. The last time a Republican won statewide in New York was when George Pataki won his third term as governor in 2002.
Pataki said the ingredients for a statewide win are there if you have a GOP candidate who can attract some Democrats.
If you want people to not vote their party, you have to have someone who is able to articulate why they should do that.
Both Blakeman and Lawler talk about bipartisanship, but they also emphasize their ties to Trump. Back in Binghamton, several dozen protesters gather outside Blakeman's speech. Barbara Mullen, a co-leader of the local Indivisible group, says Trump and Elon Musk's work to dismantle federal agencies is a power grab.
Because of checks and balances, we expect our Republican neighbors to do their job to stand up and stop the coup.
Fred Akshar is also on hand. He's the local sheriff and a former state lawmaker. He says a lot of what Republicans hope to do in New York depends on Washington.
I mean, there are still a lot of anti-Trump, anti-Elon Musk people amongst us. If we don't produce on behalf of the American people, then we will suffer for that.
The latest poll shows Trump's job approval in New York has ticked down to 42%. In Binghamton, I'm Jimmy Vielkind for the New York Public News Network.
Listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. This week I sat down with Lynn Porodnik, a medical marijuana doctor based in Westchester County. She's part of a coalition pushing New York to do better when it comes to medical cannabis. Welcome back to the Legislative Gazette, Dr. Porodnik.
Thank you, David. I am taking a whole new stance. I've joined forces with a lawyer and a group of really interesting people who really want to pursue this as medicine. With the changes of New York, recreational, doctors are telling patients, go to the dispensary, ask the bud tender. But there is a core of patients that really need to use this as medicine. So we got together and did Lobby Day March 11th on the steps in Albany, which was a really fun experience.
Tell us who was there in terms of legislators and who is supporting you in your efforts to really define medical cannabis from the recreational cannabis that's here. And I know your attorney is Jeffrey Hoffman.
Right. Jeffrey Hoffman's been really interested in making changes for patients. He understands their needs and is willing to roll his sleeves up. So Assemblywoman Kellis is the sponsor for the bill in the Assembly. Crystal People Stokes came. They give us a really warm welcome. And afterwards, we visited different offices. Peter Horkum has agreed to sign on. If this passes in the Assembly, he's agreed to be the senator of record for this to push things forward. And it's an interesting bill because it really incorporates a few basic things. The first bill is about introducing cannabis in medical school curriculum in New York. The endocannabinoid system is not discussed or taught, so doctors really know nothing about this, although this is the overriding system for control in the body from everything from sleep, hunger. It just keeps us in the middle of the road. But yet in medical school, we don't learn about it. The second bill is about removing the excise tax on medical marijuana so the prices would go down for patients and make it more accessible. And the last bill is about New York insurance companies who pay for medications for patients will now be paying for cannabis for patients. If they can pay for oxycodone and fentanyl, why can't they pay for cannabis? So this is our project.
Yeah, and one of the areas that you and I have talked about over the years is the idea that more choice is better in terms of the products that are available. You've given the example of little children with seizure disorders who've been helped by certain strains of cannabis. And one of the things that I know you've noticed and have been lobbying about and have just told us about these three bills that are moving through the legislature is that what's happened once recreational marijuana made its way to the public is that the more of the choices are on the recreational menu than the medical menu.
Absolutely. And the medical menu has not kept up with current research. They're really not working with minor cannabinoids. basically what they have are the products that were set up in 2016. And times have changed. We know a lot more, and we know what can work for patients, but the emphasis is about profit. The medical companies have lost money year after year. They were hanging in there when recreational rolled out. It's rolled out, and patient care has gone down. I met a patient, not of mine, but I spoke at Heritage Hills in Somers. A gentleman came up to me after and said, I have a problem. Okay, what's the problem? He purchased products, gave them the empty bag, went to a combined rec med in White Plains. They found something else that had similar color bag, did not count it out in front of him, didn't have a conversation. So he ended up with 6 bags of a product that had nothing to do with him. So we decided we'd get together if we didn't get through on the phone. I spoke with the pharmacist who agreed to substitute in when they would get the proper medication. He, in the meantime, stood online, spoke to one of the bud tenders. Her answer was, we don't take anything back. He got back on the line. The second bud tender told him to sit on the couch. After 15 minutes, nobody still talked to him. I pulled him over and said, look, this is what they can do. But the system is broken. The basics of showing the patient the medication, counting it out so everybody understands what they paid for, it's no longer being abided by. So there's lots of programs, not just the cost. It took about 5 weeks for them to get back in stock what this patient needed, which was under the medical program. Now, when it comes to delivery, it can take 3 days, 4 days, 5 days for a medical patient to receive his stuff. Recreational, you can have it in 3 hours. What's going on?
Yeah, the other part of that is, and this is what I learned, is that the testing under the medical cannabis is much more rigorous and costs more than under the recreational cannabis, which really doesn't seem to me to make any sense. You'd want all of it to be tested rigorously at the same level, wouldn't you?
Absolutely. Well, the clinker is what fails medical ends up in recreational. So there you go. It's all about profit. And somehow, I don't think regular consumers would want medical rejects, so to speak.
Well, and then you have this, what was supposed to be, legal industry that would take care of the illegal underground industry. If anything, it's made it even more profitable, especially for young people who can get it cheaper on the illegal market.
And the products are really nice on the illegal market. You're getting a lot of products from California, Colorado, Michigan, Missouri, and Oklahoma. And it seems Missouri products are really flooding the New York market. There are these giant warehouses in the city just stocked full of pounds and pounds of cannabis and products from black market. And the prices are about half, and the quality is very nice. But New York isn't really very aggressive about shutting them all down.
Yeah, and then, you know, as you talk about this industry, you have people like you, the medical marijuana doctors, who are basically losing patients, right? Because if it's not treated like a serious medical issue, if many are just saying, hey, just go to the recreational instead, you can't prosper or even survive. And I know for you, this was a choice. You wanted to help people.
Yes, it's depressing, to be polite. Also, within the system, dispensaries are sending patients notices, renew cheap and easy with online services. 5 minutes, you will be renewed for $99. That's not how I do it, and I'm not willing to do it that way. One company offered me a job that I could do approximately 60 certifications in a day. My answer was, are you on drugs? I failed personal typing in junior high school. That's not medicine. That's secretarial work, and there's no way I will do that. I'd rather weed gardens than spend my time just cranking out paperwork. And these companies are actually violating regulations, but OCM feels they have bigger fish to fry. So the doctors are getting it from all sides. Other doctors are saying, go to the rec shop. These people are poaching our patients. They're violating three regulations in HIPAA, and nobody cares.
Well, here's the other issue that we've talked about, and it's an overriding issue when it comes to the federal government. There has been the all-important memo that said, you know, if your state is legalized, that the federal government will leave you alone. But we still don't have it legal to put in a bank account. We still face, any legal, legitimate business could still face a raid by the federal government. You know, at what point, and, you know, we have the Trump administration now. So, you know, what is your thinking on the national level as to where this industry will end up?
Very interesting question. Last Tuesday evening, I went to a meeting about what's going on now with budget cuts and Medicaid, what's going on with Elon Musk, and Chuck Schumer's press secretary was there. So after we did what we did there, I spoke with him and mentioned, you know, I'm a little sardine. I know you have big fish to fry now, but what are you doing about medical marijuana? Mr. Schumer's office has been very pro-cannabis. What are you doing about opening up banking for companies, all this 280E, business deductions? How come it's not a real business in this country? And his answer was, right now, we got to deal with this budget stuff. I will get back to you after because I'd love to hear all this information because we're really not even aware of all the details of what's going on in New York.
She is Dr. Lynn Parodnik, medical cannabis doctor in New York, joins us from time to time to talk about updates as to what's happening with medical cannabis now wrapped in and around the recreational cannabis industry in the state. Dr. Parodnik, thanks so much for joining us on the Legislative Gazette this week.
Oh, thanks so much, David. It's always a pleasure to be here.
You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. Small business owners in the Hudson Valley met with New York Congressman Pat Ryan over coffee this week to voice their concerns about the rising cost of living in the region. As the Legislative Gazette's Jesse King reports, grocery costs are among their biggest concerns.
Ryan, a Democrat from the 18th District, met with about a dozen restaurant owners, union reps, daycare managers, and chamber heads at the Alexis Diner in Newburgh. On the docket were a range of rising expenses in the region, from housing to childcare, but food costs monopolized the conversation. George Mostakis owns the I-84 Diner in Fishkill. He says the price of a single crate of eggs went from about $45 to more than $260 in recent months.
It comes out to a couple thousand dollars a week, you know, extra costs. I cannot always raise prices just like that. I mean, you can, but eventually guests will push back. They will. You will not come into the restaurant. There's no doubt about it. I would love for somebody to explain to me how eggs went to $260.
Did it have to do with the flu, that whole thing? Or
Americans have been grappling with inflation for a few years now, but egg prices reached record highs this winter amid an ongoing bird flu outbreak nationwide. Prices have since started to drop, but Mostakis still wants the federal government to investigate. He's skeptical over whether the bird flu is really to blame for the price increase, suggesting to Ryan that egg suppliers could be using the flu to price gouge customers.
I was never told in the restaurant all these couple of months that I cannot have eggs. You know, there's no eggs for the restaurant. No company has ever told me that, but they did tell me the price is high. Yeah. So if there was such a shortage, why was I never told there's no eggs?
Ryan, for his part, says there are bipartisan talks in Congress right now on whether to investigate the situation. He's reintroduced his Lower Grocery Prices Act with Congressman Mike Lawler, a Republican from the 17th District, which would require the U.S. Government Accountability Office to analyze food prices over the last 20 years and develop solutions. Other business owners Tuesday said it's efforts at the federal level that are making them nervous. The Trump administration has been working to cut federal spending and pivot away from renewable energy in favor of fossil fuels. Farmer Rick Osofsky with Ronnybrook Farm in Dutchess County says he recently received a letter from the government stating the farm will not, in fact, be getting the roughly $500,000 grant it was promised to go solar in 2023. But he says most of the work has already been done.
And there's no one to talk to. And what the administration has said, and I'm not trying to be political, is that they're not taking money away from any individual applicants that were awarded the money. Well, we're one of those people.
Ralph Arenzo, meanwhile, worries how President Trump's escalating trade war with other countries will impact his Tuttletown Spirits Distillery in Gardner. Over the years, he's grown the distillery to the point where it now exports whiskey to multiple European countries. But the European Union recently proposed a 50% tariff on U.S. whiskey in response to Trump's tariffs on steel and aluminum imports in the U.S. Now Trump has threatened to escalate things further with a 200% tariff on EU wine and liquor.
If this suggestion of a 200% excise tax on imports goes through, that'll mean that all of that work will have been wasted because those people won't pay it. They just won't pay it.
Speaking after the event, Ryan says he's still optimistic lawmakers can work across the aisle to address food costs nationwide. He says he wanted to have this meeting to hear directly from local businesses. And while he isn't necessarily surprised by what he heard, he is moved by it.
When you hear the specifics, it's a gut punch. And when you hear Tuttletown, another one of our great success stories, say that tariffs and excise taxes, which are being proposed, would be hugely harmful, I think it's really important for folks in the community to understand this isn't theoretical or hypothetical. These are real great businesses that we all love, that employ our family and our friends, and are now at real risk.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Jesse King.
5 years ago this month, New York schools shut down indefinitely because of the coronavirus. Amy Feiereisel of the New York Public News Network reports on the lasting impacts of COVID-19 on education.
In a global pandemic, no one is really left untouched.
Some families literally saw a loved one pass away during the pandemic.
That's Stephen Todd, district superintendent of the Jefferson Lewis BOCES, which serves 18 school districts near Lake Ontario.
Even the students and adults who came through the pandemic, the most unscathed, if you will, still experienced loss.
A lot of people talk about the pandemic as an accelerator and amplifier. It took existing issues, both behavioral and academic, and made them a lot bigger. Across the U.S., reading and math scores dropped and are still below pre-pandemic levels. Educators I spoke with identified students who are in 7th, 8th, and 9th grades right now as the ones struggling most academically. Christy Moore was the principal of the Glens Falls Middle School when the pandemic started.
If the environment that they were in was staring at screens and playing video games and not having a lot of social interaction, and that's how their brain was developing, it's no wonder that we're seeing, them struggling as they're, early high school students now.
She says the pandemic really widened the gap between children who had stable home lives and those who didn't. Some students had really positive experiences, family time, cooking, crafting.
Those students were enriched during that time compared to the students that were experiencing additional trauma at home.
For those kids, what that looks like today is needing more help, counseling, teacher's aides, mental health supports. Moore says behavioral issues are the worst in the youngest grades, where students are still learning emotional regulation. That's been true for several years now. In 2022, I spent time with Jessica Quimby, a first grade teacher at Salmon River Elementary School.
It's been kind of crazy, running around the room, they're fighting with each other.
Many teachers say that the fall of 2020 through the spring of 2022 was the hardest period of their careers. There was quarantining, social distancing, elaborate schedule changes, limited extracurriculars, the politicization of masks. A lot of teachers left the profession. Jennifer Gaffney is the superintendent of Sackett's Harbor Central School District.
Anybody who's eligible to retire from the superintendency, from the principalship, from teaching, even from non-instructional staff positions, it was that tough.
And that was in the middle of an existing generational turnover. Tom Burns is the district superintendent of the St. Lawrence Lewis BOCES.
We were reaching that point where it was baby boomers were starting to exit the system.
Burns says the education world is facing a demographic challenge. There are just fewer Gen Xers and millennials than baby boomers, and fewer young people are entering the teaching profession. In 2025, schools are still struggling with teacher and staff shortages. But it's not all doom and gloom. Educators do say that some accidental silver linings came from the pandemic. Byrne says that one was the rapid reevaluation of a lot of education norms.
Change is very slow in education. We have so many different stakeholder groups and constituencies.
But big changes happened, often overnight. Teachers learned over a weekend how to use a suite of virtual tools like Google Classrooms, something one educator told me would have taken a decade under normal circumstances. Schools also started to move quickly away from purely punitive measures. For example, the old punishment for not coming to school was suspension. That suddenly seemed ridiculous, said Christy Moore from the Glens Falls Central School District.
A student who might be using substances outside of school, you know, does suspension help that, or are they just going to sit home and get high? What will help change that behavior?
New York State had already been thinking about changing graduation measures to move away from the black and white regents model. Stephen Todd says that whole process was accelerated by the pandemic. It'll take a lot longer than a couple of years to understand the real impact of COVID-19. An interaction I had with a high schooler comes to mind on the day masks were no longer required in schools, early March of 2022. Aubrey Sherman was a junior at Boquete Valley's Mountain View campus in Elizabethtown.
We've lived this. This is our life. And so now to be back normal, like, what is that?
It's something everyone, especially kids, is still figuring out. For the New York Public News Network, I'm Amy Feiereisel.
And that about does it for this week's show. The Legislative Gazette is a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. We had help from the New York Public News Network. You can listen anytime at WAMCpodcast.org or anywhere you get your podcasts. Look for program number 2512. And join us again next week at this same time for more news on New York State government and politics. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm David Giustina. Support for the Legislative Gazette comes from United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org.